Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visit Britain, with information on how to be a Brit different on vacation. More details on the web at visitbritain.com/US.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Controversy rages on over the Cherokee Nation's recent denial of membership to African Americans whose ancestors were enslaved by the tribe. Until this story made headlines, many people were unaware of the long and complex relationship between Black and Native Americans. But my guest today has made it a focus of her academic career. Dr. Taya Miles is Assistant Professor of American Culture, Afro-American and African Studies, and Native American Studies at the University of Michigan. In 2005, she published Ties That Bind, the story of an Afro-Cherokee family in slavery and freedom. Tonight, she'll be accepting the prestigious Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture for her groundbreaking work. And she joins us for the hour to talk about this facet of U.S. history that is rarely given its due in either textbooks or popular culture. Taya, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So what are the roots of Native American slaveholding, such as it was in this country?
The roots of Native slaveholding really go back to the first contacts between Native people and Europeans and Euro-Americans. Many Euro-Americans actually encouraged Native people to own Black slaves as a way to prove their level of citizenship and a way to hold on to their landholdings in the United States.
So in other words, they would say, that shows that you are civilized like we are if you will enslave other human beings.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Native people, especially in the South, were desperately trying to find ways to survive and to maintain their landholdings. And so they made some compromises along the way. This is one of them.
And at what point did Native Americans begin to associate slavery with that power? Had there been times before where they would take people sort of as prisoners and use them as slaves, but not in such a formalized way?
Mm-hmm. This really started to happen in the late 1700s, and it happened in a few different ways. One way was that Europeans and Euro-Americans often encouraged Native people to capture runaway Black slaves in exchange for European trade goods. In addition, many European men who were moving to Native communities and who were living there as traders married Native women. Some of these men had Black slaves themselves, and they then passed those slaves on as property to their mixed-race Native and European children.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Dr. Taya Miles. She's Assistant Professor of American Culture, Afro-American and African Studies, and Native American Studies at the University of Michigan. What sorts of property rights did Native Americans have under early U.S. law? Was it any different for them to own slaves than it would be for a Euro-American?
It was different in a really interesting way. In Native communities, the land itself was not owned in this period. So the most expensive, most valuable property that a Native person could own was human property. This was very different because in white America, the most valuable property one could own would be land.
Were Native Americans using slaves for, I know in some cases they were using them for the exact same functions. They had sort of agricultural property. Would Native Americans who weren't involved in that sort of industry have had slaves for other purposes?
Absolutely. There really have been key differences charted between Native slave ownership and white slave ownership. And those differences really come back to cultural ways in Native communities. In large part, Native people worked with slaves sort of in a collective sense on their farms and even on their plantations, such that Euro-American government officials would come to Native farms and come to Native plantations to just try to get a sense of how the, quote, civilizing process was going. And these officials would record that Native people were not working their slaves hard enough. They were having parties with their slaves. They were out in the fields alongside of their slaves. And the sense was, on the part of Euro-American officials, that Native people couldn't quite get it right.
So they were working alongside their slaves and fraternizing with them maybe in a more comfortable way than white Americans did, but there was no question that these were masters and people considered property. Can you talk about what sort of constraints were placed on slaves by Native Americans?
Yes. And once again, this is a place where the history does differ between Native American slave ownership and Euro-American slave ownership. In Native slave holding nations, there was a really gradual and slow move toward creating what we know as slave codes. So over time in the Cherokee Nation, which is my area of focus, slave codes were passed and slaves were not able to own property. They weren't able to marry Cherokee people legally. But this didn't happen until the 1820s, 1830s, and the slave codes in the Cherokee Nation actually tightened up even more after removal, so after the 1830s.
The family that in your book you specifically look at was made up of a Cherokee father, or a man who owned several slaves, and basically took as a sort of wife one woman and had five children with her. But then when he died, she had no claim on any of his property.
Well, in the Cherokee Nation, that's right. But there are a lot of different complicated facets to this story. One is that the children of this couple actually did have Cherokee citizenship rights and did have access to the property owned by the Cherokee father.
Which is interesting because among the white community, if you had even an equal amount, there
exactly.
was no being counted as white. You were definitely considered black.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, Chris. I think this is another key place where we see a difference. In the Cherokee Nation, we have a Cherokee man who actually owned up to the fact that he had children with a black woman who was a slave. He went to the Cherokee Tribal Council. He pushed for their freedom, and he pushed for the Cherokee citizenship, so that when he died, it was his Afro-Cherokee children who inherited his farm.
So were there the same taboos about interracial relationships that existed in the white community? They happened in the white community, but nobody talked about it.
Right. There were taboos, but I don't think they were the same. And again, we're talking about differences that are quite deep culturally. So within a Native American Southern context, and we're talking especially about a Cherokee context right now, kinship norms were really important. Who you were related to, what clan you were in, was critical for determining what the relationship should be like between people. So that went for people who were Afro-Cherokee, as well as Cherokee and not of mixed African descent ancestry. This was really different than what happened in Euro-America, where race was really the key dividing line. And if you're related by kinship, that would be, as you said, kind of hidden and swept under the rug.
And what about, were there taboos from within the African-American community? Were there people who said, you absolutely should not be going to bed with someone who is not black?
In the period that I focus on for my book, which is really the 19th century, there really were not indications that black people, enslaved or free, were hesitant to intermarry with Native people. Over time, though, that has changed, such that we hear often now in some black communities that if someone claims Native ancestry, that person will be questioned about whether or not they're trying to escape their blackness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Did Cherokee slaveholders communicate with their slaves in English, or did they speak in Cherokee?
That's a great question. And they would have spoken in Cherokee for the most part. And this is another important difference between Cherokee and Native and Euro-American slaveholding. Within Cherokee slaveholding families, communities, there really was a dependence on black slaves for help with English literacy. And this was key. Many black slaves who came into the Cherokee Nation had first been slaves of white people in the States. So when they came to the Cherokee Nation, they had skills that they had picked up while they were in white communities. One of those skills was English literacy, English spoken literacy, and they were able to share that with their Cherokee owners.
So besides language, what other sorts of cultural things did they pass back and forth? And maybe I have to assume there were some things that formed in the center that were different from where either one started.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked that. Well, language is one of the key things that we see as being important and shared and malleable to a certain extent between enslaved blacks and their Cherokee owners, and also free blacks and the Cherokee people, because not everyone who was black in the Cherokee Nation or Native Nations was a slave. But other cultural artifacts that would have been passed or shared would have been techniques for basket weaving, would have been certain kinds of pottery. There have been pottery shards found, especially on South Carolina plantations, that seem to combine Native American and West African motifs and shapes. Dugout canoes is another example that African-American slaves seem to have picked up techniques from Native people and carried those techniques on. So there are many ways in which black and Native people came together culturally. A key one that I think we will all really understand immediately as being important has to do with food. A lot of the dishes that we think of as soul food, that are corn-based in the African-American community really are Native American in derivation, because, of course, the Native diet in the Southeast in this period was very much corn-rich.
And so they all sort of started, you know, passing recipes back and forth and figuring out ideas from each other.
Well, if you think about it, enslaved Black people who are living with Native people are preparing meals for them, right, are growing crops for them. So they're doing things in the ways that Native people would have done them. So similarly to a United States situation, we have Black people who are taking on cultural characteristics of the people whose labor they are doing.
Would Native people have provided any kind of education for their slaves?
Yes, absolutely. And this is another key location of difference. European Christian missionaries came to Native nations, and especially to the Cherokee Nation in this period, and set up schools and set up churches and attempted to convert Cherokee people and other Native people to Christianity. Well, we know that in a white American context, slaves were forbidden to learn how to read and write. In a Cherokee context, it was completely the opposite. Cherokee people welcomed and allowed their slaves to come to these missionary schools and to learn how to read and write. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, some of these slaves had a head start with English oral literacy and were able to help the Cherokee people to learn in these missionary schools by translating for the ministers.
Dr. Taya Miles is my guest. Her book, published in 2005, is called Ties That Bind. She will be accepting the Hyatt Prize tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You'll have your chance to talk to her in just a moment at 1-800-933-5372. First, though, we want to take a quick break and get a little update on how we're doing with our fundraising campaign. That number again, 1-800-456-5372. And Jeff Whittington, how goes it in there?
What fundraising campaign?
Don't do this. This is exactly what this is what Bill Bradley did to me yesterday when I was all proud and boned up on a sports question for him, and he pretended he didn't know what
you
I was
know what,
talking
Chris,
about.
You know, Chris, we've got some great news. We are getting close to the $60,000 mark on this drive, and when we reach we have $64,800 left to raise. When that money is raised, when the last phone call or web pledge comes in that pushes us over the edge, we will simply say thank you. And we will return to the regular programming schedule. And that is our promise to you. It's been the promise we went on the air with, a week ago Monday. And you know what? This is about the same length as a normal, in the past, before we went to this model, a normal membership drive. Now, what we're doing this hour, we had 35 contributions during the first hour of Think. We want to beat that this hour. So please call 1-800-456-5372. Our goal is to eclipse the 35 caller or online pledger that we received in the first hour of the show today. So please call right now.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number, or go online at kera.org. Think about today's conversation. Think about this conversation in particular with Dr. Taya Miles. This is an hour that we're spending on a critical facet of American history, but one which I think is unknown to a lot of people or has received really very little attention over the years. We're spending an hour. This is not a polarized 30-second headline news story about a fight somewhere. This is a story about real people and how their history is our history and how we've all shared the same background and been influenced by each other. That's something that you will not get anywhere else in this market on the broadcast dial. I can guarantee it. And I don't want to sound boastful, but I'm proud of that. And I think you're appreciative of this kind of content. We know because we hear from lots of you who are calling right now.
For example, Carolyn and Denton, Karen and McKinney, Robin and Andy and Burleson, and Francis and Dallas, also Shelton and Dallas. We're no longer waiting to hear from these folks. They have done their part for KERA, for themselves. They've helped create the public radio station that they want to hear, that they listen to every day. They've taken responsibility for it. We're just waiting to hear from you with an affordable gift of support at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org.
Think of the kinds of things that you learn on this station and the nuggets of information you get that cause you to go out and research even more on your own. For every one of those, maybe pledge $10. For every time that's happened over the past year, if it gets to be $1,000 because it's happened so often, adjust accordingly to your budget. But we would ask that you think about the importance of supporting a station that does what nothing else does in this market. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. Or, of course, we can go to kera.org. You might choose a thank you gift there. Perhaps you would like a Think mug.
Think mugs are available at the $60 membership level. Please don't wait. Please call or pledge online right now. 1-800-456-5372. We're looking for more than 35 of you this hour to keep us on track, hopefully, to finish the drive today.
Thanks.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, where you can tap into a timeless world of thinking that is critical, contextual, and cultural. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the legacy of African Americans and Native Americans throughout this country's history with Dr. Taya Miles. She'll be receiving the Hyatt Prize tonight from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. She's an assistant professor of American Culture, Afro-American and African Studies, and Native American Studies at the University of Michigan. Her 2005 book is called Ties That Bind, The Story of an Afro-Cherokee Family in Slavery and Freedom. Would you say, Taya, that slaves fared better in general under Native Americans? I mean, slavery seems awful regardless, but can you make a distinction like that?
Well, this is actually a question that people have been asking for a long time in the subject area, and I think it's really been a debate. Some people feel that we really have evidence that suggests that there really is no difference, while other people feel that African Americans enslaved by Native people had more mobility and certainly more dignity in their lives. Where I come down on this is really a place of ambiguity. The records that are created by enslaved people themselves, that is interviews with former slaves of members of tribes that are called the, quote, five civilized tribes. These are slave-owning tribes. These former slaves often say that they fared better by having owners who were Native people than other slaves they knew who were owned by whites. So when we look at the testimony of former slaves themselves, they say it was a relatively better experience. But of course, I think you're right. We have to pull back and look at the whole picture and recognize that whether one's a slave owned by a Native person or a white person, one is still a slave and does not have complete freedom.
One thing that struck me, you know, as a parent was the idea that Native peoples who owned slaves made a greater effort to keep families together than Euro-Americans did.
Well, it really depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on the Native slave owners. It depends on whether or not we're talking about a small family farm or a larger plantation. The records vary on this.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number if you'd like to ask a question. Let's talk first to Donna in Wichita Falls. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I was very interested in the idea that you do a lot of Cherokee work, and we're kin to the Ross family, that he was the chief of the Cherokees for a while. And I was interested in knowing about their background in owning slaves.
Thanks for the question, Donna. The Ross family is a very famous family in Cherokee history. As you mentioned, John Ross was principal chief for quite a long time. They were a slave-owning family, and they were a member of the Cherokee elite. It was actually not uncommon that members of the Cherokee elite and the people who really formed the Cherokee government in the 1820s and 30s were slave owners.
There were African Americans, slaves, on the Trail of Tears, as well as freed African Americans. How did their experience compare with that of full-blood Cherokees, if you want to call them that?
That's another really important question, Chris. This is something that I think often gets overlooked. The fact that there were black people, some of them enslaved, who walked on the Trail of Tears with Cherokee people. This is so critical because the Trail of Tears is an important and tragic memory for Cherokee people and also for this country as a whole. And the fact that black people who have actually suffered that as well have been forgotten makes quite a big difference, I think, in how we see this history. Black people who were enslaved and who were on the Trail of Tears often did the labor that made that march possible. So for Cherokees, the Trail of Tears was horrible. It was an incredible period of suffering. Thousands of people lost their lives, and thousands were not born who would have been born. And at the same time, we have to recognize that black people who were the slaves of Cherokees suffered in the same ways in terms of loss of life, in terms of loss of potential life, But they also had to do the work of helping to create the path that the Cherokees would walk, clearing the path, cooking the meals, doing the laundry, making it physically possible for Cherokees to actually walk that trail. So this is a tragic moment in Cherokee history, and we cannot ever cover over that fact. But I think it's important for us to see that Black people were also there and also suffered, and perhaps suffered differently in that they had to do quite a bit of the labor to make that walk possible.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about suffering differently, because one would think from, you know, this vantage point in history that they would have at some point on the Trail of Tears had an affinity in feeling really subjugated by white Americans, when in fact this wasn't really the response that was observed.
Well, it's really important that we recognize always the context of colonialism. Everything that we're talking about having to do with African-American and Native American relationships, having to do with slavery within Native nations, goes back to a colonial context in which Euro-Americans came to Native lands, usurped those lands, and pressured or coerced Native people into making choices that were really kind of awful options. So that context is quite important to keep in mind as we discuss this topic.
So there's really no way to look at it without that overriding frame of European domination of both cultures.
No, there's not. Now, we must say, we must be honest, I think, and say that within that frame, we can look at Cherokee slave owners as having made decisions that we would view as unethical and even immoral. I think we can say that. But we have to say that within the context of knowing that Cherokee people were fighting for their sovereignty and fighting for their very survival.
One thing that Cherokee seemed to have feared was that white Americans would look at them, if it's possible to look at them with greater disdain than the way they were treated, they were afraid that the white government would suddenly cross them over into the category of the way African Americans were treated.
Mm-hmm. We really see a change over time in the ways that Native people interact with people of African descent. So in the very earliest periods of contact that we have recorded, 1500s, 1600s, even early 1700s, we see Native people, and I'm talking again about the Southeast area, taking African descended people into families, trading with them, living with them on sort of an individual basis. So not making a racially based decision, but deciding this individual is a decent person, we will trade with him. That changes over time when Europeans are moving in greater numbers, when white-owned plantations are springing up on what was formerly Native lands, and Native people are making the connection between their land loss, the growth of slavery, and the fact that the people who are being enslaved are brown. And Native people are recognizing, of course, that they are also brown. So yes, the situation looks dire for Native people, and they see the possibility of being relegated to what one historian, James Merrill, has called a great colored underclass.
Did Native people have the same, obviously they recognized that they were able to use African Americans as slaves and they were able to own them and have them this way. Did they have the same kind of perception of African Americans as sort of less human in the way that Euro-Americans did of the day who owned slaves?
I think even the Euro-American situation with regard to this question is pretty complicated. So on the one hand, while there was a lot of rhetoric going on in white America about the inhumanity of Black people, we know that within the intimate spaces of plantation households, Black people and white people recognize each other as human and had to negotiate with each other in order to survive. That's on the Black side and the white side. So even in white American history, there really is an understanding that Black people are human beings. If Black people were not human beings, it would be impossible to have children with them.
So you think that point's been overplayed in some ways?
It has been. Mm-hmm. But I think your question is still a fair one, because in the Native American historical context, I still see a difference. And that difference, I think, continues to go back to this theme of kinship that I brought up earlier, that for Native people in the Southeast, for Cherokee people, and that's who we're talking about right now in particular, kinship was the critical factor for deciding how you would relate to someone. And that was not necessarily the case in white America. So Black people in Native communities and the Cherokee Nation had what I call sort of a loophole that they could sometimes move through, a loophole of protection because of how important kinship was in Cherokee community.
So if kinship has always been this important, then it certainly adds more nuance to the question of what's going on right now in the Cherokee Nation and the idea that, you know, many people are saying it's all about money and it's never been about blood. And if people had cultural relationships, then it was the same. But what I'm hearing from you is that blood was always valued over, you know, intimacy, physical intimacy,
mm-hmm.
closeness, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's happened is that, unfortunately, over time, this understanding of kinship as being able to cross racial lines has diminished, such that Native people who formerly owned slaves have moved further and further away from this concept of being kin makes you a part of the community, and closer to a more Euro-American, kind of broader American concept that race is a critical factor in how we determine relationships. So that has been a change over time, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Dr. Taya Miles. She is accepting the Hyatt Prize tonight, and she's Assistant Professor of American Culture, Afro-American and African Studies, and Native American Studies at the University of Michigan. Let's talk to Tony in Arlington. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, early on, the Native Cherokee, you know, way before the Trail of Tears, when they had their slaves, was it similar to the Americans or the whites, where they personally bought them and sold them, that split families up? Did each family own their own, or was it more of a communal type of property? I always think of the Indians having such strong kin and sense of property and communal ownership that I just wondered if they shared them amongst themselves, or did they keep them mainly within a family that owned them and kept them to themselves?
Thanks for that question. That's a great question. Well, we can actually chart the ways in which Cherokees owned and related to black slaves alongside of Cherokee culture change, which was influenced by especially the United States presence. So after the United States Revolutionary War, there were a lot of changes in the Southeast for Native people. One of those changes for the Cherokee was that they had sided with the British. So they had sided with the losing party, and their land was devastated by the U.S. Revolutionary War. So Cherokees were trying to regroup at that time. When they did regroup, they tended to move toward individual farms. So we have sort of a correlation between a movement toward individual farms that was really precipitated by the U.S. Revolutionary War and individual slave ownership on the part of Cherokee families, such that Cherokees now were living in kind of individual homesteads as opposed to larger communal areas. And those individual families were owning black slaves as a family.
And so they needed, I guess they also needed more labor as they were sort of segmented as opposed to living all together and farming together.
They needed a different kind of labor.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, but we're going to take just a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Miles to return once again to our other conversation about the way this station is supported in the community in North Texas. The way it happens is that every single year, and this always touches me, thousands of us, you know, the people who work here and you who listen, come together and make financial contributions and make sure that the station has the resources it needs to continue. 50% of the money it takes to keep public radio on the air comes from listeners, not the big underwriting corporate sponsors that you hear occasionally, not the federal government, but from you, people just like you who decide to stand up and pay for content that they think really adds something to their lives. If you are among these people, please call 1-800-456-5372 or make a contribution online at kera.org.
This is your opportunity to support KERA, to support the Think program, to support conversations like this conversation today with Professor Miles, and to sort of address an issue and a topic that has shaped the world in which we live, but to look back intelligently and sort of take a moment, or well, in this instance, to take an hour to discuss issues that often don't. You're certainly not going to hear about them on commercial stations. You're certainly not going to hear a conversation like this, not even a 2-minute conversation on a topic like this on the evening newscast. You know, in any market in this country, this is where you find this kind of thing, and it's right here in North Texas, here to serve you. We're asking you to support it at 1-800-456-5372. We had about 35 pledges in the first hour of Think Today. We've so far, Chris, had about 10 pledges. We're hoping to do better than we did in the first hour in order to try to wrap up this drive today.
Perhaps you were driving back to the office and now you're safely at a phone listening very quietly in your headphones at your desk. You can also very quietly make a contribution online if you'd like to do that. We would like the second hour Think listeners to keep up with the first hour. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number to call. Thanks to Jean in Irving, Lisa in Kennedale, Eric in Coppell. If you're interested in a thank you gift today, we've got lots to offer. You can ask the volunteer on the phone or check them out online. If you don't want another coffee mug, if you've got all the books you can read right now, you are welcome to let your entire gift go towards supporting the station. But look, if having a coffee mug or a tote bag or something is going to make you happy, we're more than happy to send that to you.
We want you to be happy as a member listener of KERA. And, you know, the way we make you happy is by bringing you the best radio programming that radio has to offer. A lot of it produced right here in the studio, right here in Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, the other programs we bring you from around the country and around the world are great programs, but the decisions to air those programs are made right across the hall here in our program director, Jeff Ramirez's office. We're not part of a network, NPR, PRI. We are affiliates of those organizations, and we purchase the programs from them so that you can enjoy them. That has a cost. We're asking you to offset that cost right now at 1-800-456-5372. $64,400 left to raise in this membership campaign. That's the final number. That's not for the hour. That's for the whole drive. So please don't wait any longer.
I would love for us to be able to get down, you know, another $1,000, $2,000. Why don't you pick up the phone and be $35 of that, or $120, or $250, or whatever works with your budget. You can set up a sustaining membership and then just do a monthly draw from your bank account. That's a great way to do it, and you can make a substantial contribution without really a substantial impact on your personal finances. The number to call is 1-800-456-5372, or you can go to KERA.org. This is a system that works because people understand that without commercials, we have to raise the money that we need somehow. We figure the most honest and direct way is to just go straight to the horse's mouth, and not that you're the horse's mouth, but boy, I'm making friends today.
It is live radio,
the truth is we want to be honest with you, and we want to tell you this is how it works. We're not trying to get rich. We're trying to just make our goal, and you can be part of that.
The truth is that really, honestly, on day 9, it gets tough to be creative and figure out ways to entice you to call. If you haven't called already, you know, we're trying to figure out a way to get you, just to get you to call 1-800-456-5372.
Imagine what we would need to say in order to motivate you to call and pretend that we just said it. That's what I said. You already know why you love the station. You already know what you can afford. So give us a call now. And I can tell you this. We will use your money wisely. We will provide the content that you count on all the time. And we will be exceptionally grateful to you for taking the time, making the effort, and, you know, sacrificing a bit of your hard-earned cash for this station. The number is 1-800-456-5372. And you can go online to KERA.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, where you can tap into a timeless world of thinking that is critical, contextual, and cultural. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My guest is Dr. Taya Miles. She'll be accepting the Hyatt Prize this evening at the Dallas Museum of Art from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. We are talking about the roots of African-American and Native American relationships in this country. And the telephone number to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to Patrick in Dallas. Hi, Patrick.
Osceola, Dr. Miles. How are you?
Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I wanted to say thank you very much to NPR for revisiting this issue, because the last time it was mentioned, which was before the constitutional amendment vote in the Cherokee Nation, they missed a very important point that I was hoping Dr. Miles could address, and that is the catch-22 that the Freedmen descendants find themselves in, because the Dawes Commission refused to assign a blood quanta to most of the freedmen at the time that the rolls were open, because they subscribed to the old doctrine of one drop of quote-unquote black blood made one black, and that therefore a lot of the freedmen descendants who do in fact have quote-unquote Indian blood can't prove it because their predecessors, their families, weren't given a blood quanta rating when they signed up for the Dawes roll.
Could it not be proved with DNA?
I'm sorry?
I'm wondering about issues even of DNA, if that sort of negates the issue in some ways.
Well, let me come back to the DNA question and say, Patrick, you said it better than I could say it. I mean, I think this is something that Cherokee activist David Cornsilk has said, and that is that the descendants of freed people in the Cherokee Nation are actually paying for a crime committed against their ancestors. And that's the crime that you've just laid out. That is, when the Dawes rolls, that is the big census of Cherokee people that was taken in the 1880s and 90s, that's used to determine citizenship today. When that roll was completed, people who were slaves, people who looked like they may have been black phenotypically, were put down on the freedmen roll, what's called the freedmen roll. And if they had any Cherokee ancestry, that was not recorded. So there is no way to go back to that census and to determine through that documentation who really may have had Cherokee ancestry.
And what about the question, are people using DNA evidence now?
Well, there's been an attempt to do this, to try to use DNA as a way to determine who are the descendants of freed people of these nations really may have had Native ancestry. But this DNA route has really proven to be disappointing. It is not a foolproof way of determining what might be the truth of people's familial relationships in the past. And there are many reasons for that. There's a sociologist named Troy Duster who wrote about this and who explained that the methods that we have for determining DNA relationships are really quite narrow. So we can determine someone's mother's mother's mother back into the past and someone's father's father's father, but not someone's mother's father. So that is what he calls sort of an arbitrary branch off the family tree that we're looking at. This means that even though DNA may seem to be some kind of foolproof scientific way of determining who was who back then, it's really not.
So you sort of instantly cut out half of a person's genetic history when you do a test like this.
Exactly, and even more than half.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk to Eileen in Denton. Hi, Eileen.
Hello, Dr. Miles. Thank you for your fascinating study. I'd like to get your input as a scholar of African American studies. I know that you go back and forth between using the terms enslaved blacks and black slaves. Could you talk about any distinctions you see there and maybe what you tell your undergraduate students about the usage of those terms?
Sure, Eileen, and thanks so much for the question. For a long time in my career, I used the term slaves, and I used it without thinking very critically and consciously about what it indicated. But over time, especially as I've been doing a new research project that's really looking at representations of black people who were enslaved on plantations in the South, looking at those through actual plantation museums, through that research, I've really come to see that if we maintain this language of referring to people simply as slaves, we forget the fact that this was a crime committed against them, that they were held as property, as opposed to the idea that this was some fundamental and telling aspect of their character that the term slave alone seems to suggest. So when I say enslaved, I'm actually trying to correct the record in my own mind and to help us to remember that people who were forced to work as slaves had something done to them, that is, they were enslaved, and that there's much more that we have to learn about their lives, their personalities, their experiences that cannot be encompassed in that simple word.
I wonder if you've gained some perspective on how we get all Americans to understand that this is our history. In the same way, you know, there may be African Americans who say, okay, this is my history. There may be, you know, Native Americans who say that's their history. White Americans may look back and say, did my ancestors own slaves? But the truth is, all of these individuals as Americans, in my mind, are our ancestors. But it doesn't seem like even people who mean very well identify in the same way with sort of the other groups, especially across racial lines.
This is one thing that has been standing out to me more and more clearly over time as I've been doing this research, and that is that our history as a nation is a quilt. It is one fabric. And all the different strands that we have viewed previously as being separate really are not separate. They're completely entangled and completely enmeshed. So for a long time, many people didn't even think that there were deep and significant historical connections between African Americans and Native Americans. Well, now we see that there were many deep and close connections and relationships. And we also see, as we work on those relationships and work on trying to unearth the details about them, that they themselves were completely ensconced in larger relationships between Black people and Native people, between Native people and white people, between Black people and white people, and also between all the other ethnic and racial groups in this country. So there really is no separation. The idea of separation, I think, is a myth.
Do you think we're making progress in the way that we teach, especially younger children? I don't even mean undergrads, but I mean, you know, the first exposure we have to American history. Are we better than we were, you know, when we were in school?
I think that we are better. And I think that a part of that change has to do with more and more research coming out that is exploding this myth that we are a monoracial nation, or that we are even just a nation of Black and white. The more research that comes out, the more it will be used in the schools. And I think also that there's a social experience that's pushing this forward, and that is many more people are marrying across racial and ethnic lines. And the children of those unions are creating new identities for themselves, finding new languages to explain who they are. And so they will demand a new kind of history.
That's interesting because, yeah, it doesn't make sense to pick one or the other, or even necessarily to say I'm half this and half that. People are beginning to just not use those terms to decide what they are culturally.
Right. It does not make sense. And we can even go back to the Cherokee history topic to find an example for this. In the period that I'm looking at in my research in the 19th century, when a Cherokee person married a person who was not Cherokee, the child or children of that union would not say, I'm half this and half that. I'm half Cherokee and half Black. I'm half Cherokee and half white. They would say they were Cherokee, because having a parent of another ancestry or another heritage did not diminish or take away their Cherokee-ness. I think that they had it right and that we've got it wrong when we try to make people determine that they are one or another.
There is a National Archives, I don't know, outlet or branch in Fort Worth, and there are a lot of the Cherokee rolls that exist there. I'm wondering what you find that sort of you can read between the lines when you're looking through documents like this.
Absolutely. The people who are here in Dallas-Fort Worth have an unbelievable treasure, because the National Archives Southwest branch in Fort Worth has all of the records for the Native tribes that held slaves, and also other Native tribes in the West and some from the South who were removed to the West. And one of the fascinating things that you can see in these records is the application cards that were made out by the former slaves of people in these nations. So you don't just have to rely on the Dawes roll to see who ended up on that list. You can see who tried to get on the list. And for looking at those records, you can get another sense, sort of an alternative sense of who may or who may not have been a part of that larger Cherokee community.
Can anyone go and get this information, or is it for scholars only?
Anyone can go. They have wonderful hours. They're open quite early in the morning. You can access their information via the website. If you just look up National Archives, you can even look up NARA Southwest Branch. You can go right over.
You've already got the website memorized. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. Dr. Taya Miles will be receiving the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. Her book, published in 2005, is called Ties That Bind, The Story of an Afro-Cherokee Family in Slavery and Freedom. Such a pleasure to have you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We are congratulating you right now for being a supporter of this station at 1-800-456-5372. You can also go to kera.org. We're really hoping that today will be the day when we're able to wrap up this membership campaign. The more calls we have now, the more we chip away at that overall goal. We started needing, what, $360,000, Jeff?
Yeah, way back on Monday the, was it Monday the 16th?
It felt like the 16th of January, but it was just
that's
a week
right, ago. That's right. And we've done very, very well, thanks to many, many actually, a couple of thousand of you have joined the station in the last 9 days or so, or renewed your membership. A few of you have joined just in the last few minutes. Brenner in Tulsa, Ronald in Dallas, Beverly in Plano have each done your part for KERA by calling 1-800-456-5372 or by going online to kera.org. Chris, $64,000 remains to be raised in this membership campaign. We can do that very quickly, very efficiently, if you will call right now.
1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number, or of course you can go online to kera.org. It's a quick and easy thing to become a member of the station. If you have a credit card and that's how you like to do things, we can get you in and out in about 60 to 90 seconds. And if you are going to write a check, that's fine too. You can also set up a sustaining membership. And the way that works is you can call and set it up, or you can go online. There's like a little form there that you fill out. It doesn't take much more time, but it puts your membership on a system where every month your bank will transfer automatically, you know, $5 or $7 or $25. $5, whatever amount you decide you want to set up as your contribution to KERA, your own form of philanthropy to your public radio station. The money goes right to work for you, and you're able to check up on how that's happening because you can flip on your radio any old time of the day or night and hear it.
Yeah, it's your support that allows KERA to offer the very best radio programs really that exist. I'm talking about All Things Considered, Morning Edition, The Diane Rehm Show, Fresh Air, the weekend programs that you listen to. We're thrilled that the program that we make, that you're listening to right now, Think, has a place among those programs and is able to respond to local, regional, as well as international and national issues and give you a chance to talk to some of these people. We had Senator Bill Bradley in here yesterday, you know, one of the presidential contenders a few years back, with a great conversation. We've had the ambassadors from Pakistan and Iraq to the United States have sat in the studio with Chris and answered your questions on the phone. That's got to be worth something to you to support that kind of programming.
You know, we are proud that we have guests that you, in fact, I was talking to Senator Bradley yesterday. He's supposed to do the Colbert Report next week, and he's got the tour going of different national media. We're really proud that we have national level guests for you. We're also very proud to be able to turn around and focus on things that are happening just in this community. And no matter what, we think that there is a North Texas flavor because the program is produced here, because you are able to interact with any of our guests that you choose to. And because we sort of look at things, you know, we can't help it, but look at things from a North Texas perspective. If that's something that you value, please call 1-800-456-5372. It only happens because people just like you decide to become supporting members.
Hopefully we won't, you won't have another chance after this hour to support Think during this membership campaign, because we'd like to wrap things up today. If not today, then first thing tomorrow morning. So we do want to take this opportunity to support everyone, or to thank every one of you who has supported this show over the past week. It's really overwhelming to get that kind of vote of confidence for the work that we do, of course, in service of you. But we really do appreciate your support at 1-800-456-5372.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, Radio Unlimited. The joke we make around here is that radio is unlimited. Sometimes resources are limited, but we are able to get just enough thanks to you. And as soon as we get just enough, we quit fundraising. We're not here to sort of stuff the coffers with extra cash with this kind of fundraising. We do just as little as it takes to get what we need, and then we'll just come back to you the next time, you know, our schedule permits and we need the money. So we're honest with you. We tell you what we need, we raise it, and then we'll leave you alone for a while. So if you can help us out at this moment, please do. 1-800-456-5372.
Yeah, we certainly don't all have brand new motorcycles with matching leather jumpsuits. I don't know why that image popped into my head.
It's the Evel Knievel style public radio.
The dream radio station where everybody gets brand new matching motorcycles. But that's not happening here. We're bringing you the programming, and we're bringing you guests from faraway places. Melanie McGrath, we were on the phone with her in London today in the first hour. You know, those things have a cost. To bring you these conversations, there is a cost associated with, I mean, the electricity bill for a radio station. I've never seen it. I don't want to see it. I think it would scare the dickens out of me, because to imagine broadcasting these conversations all over the North Texas area, it all has a cost, and we're just asking you to help pay for 53% of that cost, which is 53% of the funds necessary to run this station come directly from listeners.
I think, truthfully, Jeff, just running the air conditioner to keep – this is not for our comfort, mind you. It's the equipment must be kept cold, and that can't be cheap, because it's
right.
Always pretty
well,
chilly.
Well, it's
here.
Just, you know, think of every expense that you have to run your personal household or your business if you own a business. And then, you know, we have to have we had to pay for all those bills for KERA, but we also had to pay for the national programs, which runs close to about $1 million a year. So your support is crucial to keep this program on the air, to keep all of these programs on the air, and to keep the service that you rely on healthy. Please call 1-800-456-5372.
And, you know, that said, we all do what we can to keep this all healthy financially. You know, we have people running around here turning off lights all the time because we want, you know, we understand that your money comes from you and that it is a gift to us. And we never want to take that for granted. We use it as carefully as we can. We, you know, I always talk about this, but Jeannie Mascoro never, ever prints anything out on a clean piece of paper.
She really doesn't.
Rifles through the recycling basket. And she'll get pieces of paper and print things out so that, so, you know, I actually like it. She always laughs at me for telling that story. I think it's great.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
You know, some things we have to run the first time.
I'm not going
to
eat the recycled paper sandwiches, though, that someone suggested. I'm just not going to do it. 1-800-456-5372.
How do you get a little Louisiana hot sauce? They're not so bad.
$64,000 to go to make the goal. Please don't wait. Please call now. 1-800-456-5372 or online at KERA.org. Thank you so much for your support of this show and for KERA.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.